This presentation has been previously broadcast.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
And just like that, we are back. Back in the saddle. Who is it that said that? Aerosmith? Patrick Madrid here. My number is 888-914-9149. 888-914-9149. You can call me now. We'll get you on the air with your comment. I saw this and I had a reaction to it. Okay, this is an article. These are interesting articles. I like articles like this from Popular Science. Five animals that can sense things that you can't. All right. The more we learn about other species, the less impressive even our sharpest sensory powers become. Take sight, for example. Pit vipers have infrared vision. Bees can view ultraviolet light, and electric eels use their zaps to see through the murky waters of the Amazon. These animals and others have evolved to experience aspects of the world that sit beyond the borders of our perception. That's all true. And some of their superpowers would be downright awful if ported over to a human. Imagine having taste receptors all over your body, which is the case for catfish. Ooh. Let's see. So they give some examples of things that these various animals can do. So vampire bats, they have blood vision. They can see blood thanks to heat-sensitive channels in their noses. Fat and juicy blood vessels emit warmth, and the flying mammals track those temperatures on food sources like cattle and chickens, hopefully not people. Dolphins, Echo Utero. Sounds like a prog rock band, doesn't it? Echo Utero. Soft materials like sand can't hide a dolphin's prey. Their echolocation allows them to glimpse inside sand or under sand, which has led some scientists to speculate that the sea mammals might even be able to detect human pregnancies. Harbor seals. They have wired whiskers. Seeing and hearing are no problem for seals, but they use another sense to catch dinner. There are 80 whiskers attached to the thousands of sensory receptors around their mouths. They can detect the path of a fish minutes after it's fled the scene. Okay. Sheet web spider. Electric field detecting leg hairs cue these crawlers to go ballooning in favorable skies. I'm not even sure what that means. I think that means they go up in the air. When they sense a positive atmospheric charge, they release a strand of negatively charged silk, which helps them to slip upward and catch a ride on the wind. Up, up, and away, or something like that. And an elephant. Pachyderm feet packed with vibration-sensing nerve endings can feel low-frequency trumpeting from up to 9 miles away. The animal can even tell who's calling from 9 miles away, and I presume that would be a fellow animal. I think things like that are interesting, but I come back to, I guess, my first reaction to the article when I first read it is animals are cool. Animals can do some amazing things. That's true. No question about it. They can do some things that we can't do. But you know what? Human beings are higher on the scale of the created order than animals are. So as much as we love our animals and as much as we enjoy their company and all of the above, we should never forget that animals are lower than we are. And the reason I think we should say that is because sometimes people, I think, put animals on the same plane as human beings. And they value human life maybe less than animal life in some cases. So just a thought. 888-914-9149. Back to the phones. Let's go now to Jeff in Burbank, California. Good morning, Jeff.
Hey, good morning, Patrick. Love your show.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you for your formidable apologetics on our faith. I'm a confirmed Catholic. I love my faith.
Thank you.
Actually, I live in Santa Clarita. So on the subject of Jesus being dramatized in movies and television, So I just have a comment for you. But I was wondering if you knew about that show, The Chosen.
I do know about it. Excuse me. I saw one episode of it all the way through, and I enjoyed it.
Okay.
Some of my adult children have been raving about it and saying how much they loved it. I just haven't seen more than that one episode, but I haven't heard anything negative. Everyone I know who's seen it, they seem to love it. They seem to think it's really Very moving.
It is fantastic. Yes, sir. It is fantastic. And you know what? I've heard good things about Jesus of Nazareth as well by Franco Zeffirelli. Mm-hmm. So now that you've recommended it, I'm going to make that next on my list to watch.
Oh, good.
But I highly encourage you to sit down and watch the rest of The Chosen. There's only two seasons so far. But it's sensational, and the acting is top notch. There are moments that are just dramatized so beautifully. And what's great about it, Patrick, is you can watch it with the kids, and it's and it shows you the ministry of Jesus Christ, and it's beautiful.
I had one moment in the one episode that I did watch that struck me kind of the wrong way. And it was, as I recall, because it's probably a year or so now that I saw that, but I recall where Jesus, I think, meets Mary Magdalene for the first time, and
right.
She's coming out of a brothel. I don't know what it was exactly, but I don't remember. But she's coming out of a building, and he's outside. And the one thing that struck me wrong was that Jesus sort of puts his hands around her head. And he's close to her, and he says something like, "You are mine." Now, I understand theologically what that means, and you know, obviously there's nothing incorrect about that. But the way in which it was filmed, it suggested a kind of romantic intimacy that I'm sure obviously did not exist. And that was my one complaint with that episode that I saw. And I wish that they had handled that somewhat differently. But maybe if you go back and rewatch it, you'll see what I saw, but that's definitely the one red flag I saw.
Okay, well, fair enough. Well, I can tell you that until episode 3 is really when the show launches, because that's the first episode where we see Jesus as both God and man, and I just think just so personable, and his first episode is all about him just giving his ministry to children who befriend him in the countryside. And it's just wonderful. And I'll have to go back and watch that last scene. And I think it was the first episode, like you said. I think that if it came across that way, I highly doubt that was the director creator's intent.
I bet it wasn't.
After looking at
behind
the scenes. Yeah. And it's too bad that it came across that way for you.
And maybe I'm the only one that it came across that way for. It could be that too. And I recognize that sometimes I might see something and I don't really like that, but I see it again. I realize, oh, okay, it's not what I thought. It just seemed like, it seemed like what a man who is attracted to a woman would do, and putting your hands around her head and kind of drawing her close to you that way just seemed like not something Jesus would have done, but you know, that's it. That's my the only wrinkle that I found in that one that I saw. But I will watch the other ones, Jeff.
All right.
And I appreciate the recommendation. I hope you'll watch Jesus of Nazareth. I found out not that long ago that the entire 6 hours of it is available in, I think it's high definition, for free on YouTube. And you can get the whole enchilada as one gigantic video on YouTube. But it also has it broken up into parts. So like part one, part two, etc. Or you can, of course, download it from Amazon Prime or something like that. But I hope you enjoy that. Thanks for the call. Let's go now to John in San Diego. Hello, John. Welcome.
Thank you, Patrick. Thank you for taking my call. Patrick,
sure.
I would like any information you may have in regards to the absolution of St. Leo. I'm a fan of history, was stationed at Coronado for 22 years, three combat tours, worked, let's just say stationed at Coronado. And in the movie The Valkyrie with Tom Cruise, Colonel von Stauffenberg, a Luftwaffe colonel, asked the Pope for the absolution of St. Leo, which my understanding, Patrick, and please correct my naivete if I'm wrong, ask for forgiveness for sins you may have committed in this life. Basically, you're doing something bad in order to save a greater evil from happening in the future. Does that still exist? Basically, it's forgiveness on the battlefield, Patrick, and this is an issue that troubles me, for lack of a better term.
Well, I'm. Let me make sure that I'm understanding your question. So as you ask me that question, I'm looking here and I see this. Okay, it says, when King Macbeth of Scotland came to Rome to seek forgiveness for his crimes, Leo pronounced, this is Pope Leo the Ninth, Leo pronounced the absolution. He directed King Edward the Confessor of England to build what later became Westminster Abbey. Now, is that Pope Leo you're thinking of, and is that the incident? Because it's an historical detail that I did not know about. But is that the one you're wondering about?
Yes.
Okay. So now help me understand the question then. So are you wondering if that was a valid absolution, or what is the question exactly?
I'm wondering if that's a valid absolution. And could you give me a historical context on perhaps if the Crusaders, who entered the Holy Land, were also given absolutions in regards to sins that they may commit in the future?
Okay. So, no, you can, no priest, or, you know, bishop for that matter, can absolve somebody from a sin that they have not yet committed. Nor can a priest or bishop grant, what would we call it, permission, license, to say to somebody, you can commit a sin and we'll take care of that with some absolution. But go ahead and commit the sin and then we'll absolve you. They can't do that either. So you're silent. What is, there's something deeper here, John. What is it? Tell me.
Patrick, I think I would probably have to see you in person. I live in Coronado and I'm just not prepared.
I can't really hear you, John. I apologize. I don't know if you're outside in the wind or something, but it's hard to hear you. Maybe if you want to call back with a better connection, but I couldn't hear anything you were just saying. So give me a call back if you want. We can take it a little bit further. It's up to you. 888-914-9149. We'll go now to Joseph in Oceanside, California. Good morning, Joseph.
Hello.
How old are you?
I wanted to ask if the scapular means it saved you from hell or not, because my sister said you have to do 5 holy things, and on the first Saturday, when you're in purgatory, it'll raise you up to heaven. I wanted to know what answer is correct.
Mm-hmm. Sure. How old are you, by the way, Joseph?
I'm 9 years old.
9. Congratulations. I remember being 9 years old myself. It's a great time of life. Okay. So what has to happen for anyone to go to heaven is that that person has, when he or she dies, has to be what we say in the state of grace. Now, the state of grace means that you love God and you're seeking to do his will and you're sorry for any sins that you've committed, especially any serious sins that you've committed, and you want to be with God in heaven. If you die in the state of grace, you'll go to heaven. If somebody dies and they are not sorry for their sins, and let's say maybe they don't even believe in God, well, they won't go to heaven. They'll go to hell. So if somebody dies in the state of grace and goes to purgatory, which is where the soul is cleaned up and prepared to see God face to face in heaven, and if that soul who has gone to purgatory, if the person in this life had been wearing a scapular in a form of devotion and asking Mary, Our Lady, to pray for that person, then she has made a promise, Our Lady of Mount Carmel, she made a promise that she would pray in a very special way for those people who had worn the scapular as a sign of devotion, and that she would pray that they would be released from purgatory on that Saturday after they died. So that is a prayer that she made. I'm sorry, that is a promise that she made. So you know how your mom and dad have wedding rings on their hands?
Yes.
Okay. So the wedding ring on your mom's hand, it doesn't make her married, nor does the wedding ring on your dad's hand make him married, but it's a sign, it's a symbol that they are married. Okay. So having that ring So like if your mom took the ring off, it doesn't mean that she's not married now. She's still married, but the ring is a sign that she's married. And in the same kind of way, when you are a scapular, it's a sign, it's a reminder to you and someone who might see you wearing a scapular, it's a reminder that you love Mary and Jesus, Jesus and Mary. And it's a reminder to you that you're asking Mary to pray for you, you see. So her promise is that if you're wearing the scapular and you're wearing it with devotion and out of love for God and love for her, that she will pray in a very special way that you will get out of purgatory. Does that answer your question?
Okay, yes.
Good. I'm glad you're thinking about these things. That's good. So if you're 9 years old, I'm guessing you're probably either in third or fourth grade. Is that right?
Yeah. Right now I'm in summer. I'm going to go into fourth.
Good for you. I hope you have a great summer, Joseph. You have any things planned for the summer?
We're going, this week we're going to Minneapolis with my dad, and we're going to two camps, and my mom has a full-time job at an after-school program.
That sounds like so much fun. Well, I hope you have a good time at camp, Joseph. And
Thank you.
Yeah, keep saying your prayers, and tell your mom thank you for her letting you call me, okay?
Okay.
All right. Talk to you later. Bye-bye. 888-914-9149. Those are the best calls, don't you think, Jake? Let's go to Susan in St. Petersburg, Florida. Hi, Susan.
Hey, Patrick. I have a question.
Did
Blessed Mother suffer with labor pains when she gave birth to Jesus?
Well, by rights, we can say this, that in Genesis chapter 3, where God is pronouncing the maledictions upon the serpent in the garden as well as upon human beings, one of those that he says to Eve is that you will, in pain, you will bring forth children. So you will labor in pain. So birth pains are part of the fall. And so by rights, Our Lady did not suffer those, or we could say this, that she would not have had to suffer those by rights because she was not subject to original sin. She was not subject to the ravages of the fall because of her Immaculate Conception. So she remained sinless and free from the condition of original sin from the moment of her conception. So that much we can posit. But she also experienced other things that are not, or you know, that were part of the penalties of the fall. So she experienced immense suffering, watching her son Jesus, for example, in his passion. We know that at some point at the end of her life that she died. Now, what exactly that meant, we don't know because she was assumed bodily into heaven shortly after her death, but that too is something that accrued to Adam and Eve and all the rest of us because of the fall. And by rights, Our Lady was not subject to death, and yet it seems that it was God's will that she, you know, she said yes to all the sufferings that came her way. One clue to this is found in Revelation chapter 12, where we see St. John say, "Then I beheld a great sign in the sky, a woman clothed with the sun," and he talks about the mother of this male child. The male child literally in that context is Jesus. So the mother, literally speaking, would be Mary. And it says that that she was wailing aloud in pain as she labored to give birth. And the child she gave birth to was this male child who is Jesus. So that raises the question now, should that be understood in the literal sense that Mary literally had labor pains? Not necessarily. Some point out that that refers to the woman there in a more mystical sense, refers to Israel. And Israel is the woman portrayed there. Now, that may be true, and there may be different levels of meaning in Revelation chapter 11, beginning in verse 1. But I just notice every time I think about that, that it's possible that this is a clue to answer your question, that maybe, in fact, not because she was subject to the penalties of the fall, but because she willingly entered into those sufferings that were not proper to her because she was immaculately conceived, that it's possible that Our Lady did experience labor pains. We don't know with any certitude. We're not told by divine revelation. And there have been various theological opinions among the fathers and others as to what actually happened there, but we don't know with certitude. So it seems that that passage in Revelation 12 is at least interesting when we consider the life of Our Lady. Does that make sense, Susan?
It certainly does, Patrick. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. You're most welcome.
All
it's
right.
A fascinating topic. Thank you. Great to talk to you. Quick time out, and we'll come back with more of your phone calls. This would be the perfect opportunity for you to get in. If you're getting a busy signal when you call, we just had a line open. So call now. We'll get you on the air, 888-914-9149. I'll be right back. The programming you hear throughout the day on the Relevant Radio Network is sponsored in part by Christendom College. More info at getprinciples.com. We thank them for supporting Relevant Radio.
Keeping it relevant. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Join the conversation at 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149.
We are back. Thanks for listening. The number is 888-914-9149. 888-914-9149. A lot of people are gloating. The Daily Mail has an article about how religion isn't the secret to happiness, global study claims. So I'll just share that briefly with you, and then we're going to go to the phones. Atheists are just as happy as devout religious believers, the study said yesterday. You can just picture the people gloating. Like, oh, this is going to take all the air out of all those Christians because they think that believing in God makes you happier. No. So it continues. It confounded the long-accepted convention that confirmed Christians and the convinced followers of other faiths are happier and more content with their lives than those without religion. But the researchers found that either a firm belief in God or strong atheist views are more likely to lead to a satisfied mind than a loose attachment to religious faith. The findings are based on happiness surveys carried out in 24 countries, which asked both about religious belief and levels of satisfaction with life. Academics from the Journals of Happiness Studios at the University of Cologne in Germany divided levels of belief or non-belief into four categories. They found that all except the weakly religious, weakly as in W-E-A-K, showed similar levels of life satisfaction, and all were higher than the weekly religious groups. Now, weekly does not mean like every week. They're talking about if you are weak in your faith. They said the importance of Christianity to happiness has been exaggerated because the evidence is often drawn from America and its large Bible Belt population of believers. The findings conflict with those, and by the way, it may be true, for all I know, statistically at least, it may be true in America. So for them to poo-poo this simply because the evidence is drawn from America, people are going to be different in different parts of the world, if you ask me. So the article continues. A project published in 2019 by the respected Washington-based Pew Research Center said actively religious people were happier than non-religious people in half of the 36 countries it looked at. It found religious people were notably happier than others, not only in the U.S., but in Japan, Australia, and Germany. A British study carried out by academics from Lancaster University said this spring that teenagers who believe in God have scored higher on GCSE results. That's a British test matrix. The Cologne researchers said religion and happiness depend heavily on the country involved. That's my point. In strictly religious countries, atheists are less satisfied with their lives, but ratings improve the more liberal countries with a high proportion of non-believers. They suggested that this could be linked to discrimination against atheists in theocracies or highly religious states. The findings were based on the Swedish-based World Values Survey, a collaboration between social scientists covering 100 countries, including Britain, and 400,000 people who were polled. Researcher Katarina Pohl said, "Previous research has predominantly found evidence for a universal and linear relationship between religiosity and life satisfaction, which has led to the conclusion that highly religious people are more satisfied with life than non-religious people. The reasons for this belief is previous study. I'm sorry. The reason for this belief is previous studies were mainly focused on U.S. American samples without taking the influence of differences between countries into consideration, as well as not differentiating between non-religious subgroups. The impact of religion on life satisfaction depends on multiple factors, among others, the type of non-religious subgroup to which an individual belongs, the country's social norm of religiosity, and societal levels of development. Well, that's all. I mean, there's nothing in here that is particularly surprising. And, you know, those who are gloating and saying, well, look, the atheists are just as happy as Christians. Yeah, so what? That doesn't prove anything one way or the other. And the fact that there were some studies, whether here in the U.S. or elsewhere, that seemed to correlate a higher level of satisfaction among Christians because they believed in God, that doesn't prove anything either. This is the thing to when you approach a topic like this, especially a story like this, I would say look at it for what it is. So if people poll higher as being satisfied with life, happier, quote unquote, whatever that word may mean, and it means different things to different people. You know, if you're happier and you don't believe in God, all right, that's great. Good for you. But what does that prove? It doesn't prove anything other than maybe for a given person or a given group of people in a given country that maybe conditions prevail more in the direction of being happier if you are part of the bigger herd of people who believe in God, or maybe you live in an atheistic country where the majority of people don't believe in God. So if you fit in better because you don't believe in God, okay. But ultimately, it doesn't really prove anything. It certainly doesn't prove that God exists or doesn't exist. I mean, far from it. So since people are buzzing about it, and I've seen a few people even gloating about it, I thought I would just offer you some thoughts. And we'll get a link to that posted for you on the show Twitter feed, which is at P Madrid Show. But you can access everything on the Twitter feed by going to the show page, relevantradio.com/Patrick. We'll go to Kathy in Medford, Wisconsin. Hi, Kathy.
Hi. Thank you for your show. It's wonderful.
Thank you.
I have three questions about a scapular. The felt pad, I do not like things hanging around my neck.
Okay.
So if I cut the felt pad off and put it in my pocket, is that okay?
Yeah, I mean, wearing the scapular traditionally, as you know, is you wear it around your neck, over your shoulders. That's where the word scapular comes from, because that's the Latin word. Scapula is the Latin word for shoulders. But, I mean, if you have some reason why you can't wear it that way, it's not as though you're going to be penalized. The main thing is your devotion, you see. So
right.
If you, yeah, okay, so we dispatched that question.
Okay.
Good.
The second one is, what's the difference between a brown and a green scapular?
Well, the brown scapular is associated with Our Lady of Mount Carmel. That's the oldest version. That's the kind of the traditional one. I would need to look up the origin of the green scapular, but that's recognized by the church as well, and many people like the green scapular. I think it has something to do, if I'm not mistaken, with the special intention for those who are sick or suffering from some illness. But without double-checking the background of it, I don't want to take a guess.
Right.
So they're,
okay.
They're different forms of the same devotion.
Okay. And the third one is, do they make a metal form you could wear that would be sufficient?
Like yeah, a there's a scapular metal. Mm-hmm.
Oh, there is?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great.
Your local church
well,
goods
my
store. Well, I'm happy. And the local church goods store near you would, I mean, Catholic, obviously,
right.
would either carry it or they could order it for you.
Okay. Thank you much.
You're welcome, Kathy. Great talking to you. How about Charlie in Greenwood, Indiana? How are you doing, Charlie? Welcome.
Fine. Welcome. Thank you, Patrick. I have a question concerning the Virgin Mary.
Okay.
She was human, and she was on this earth. When she was assumed into heaven, did she become omnipotent so that when we say our prayers, if we say quietly to God, he can hear us and know what we're praying? But with the Virgin Mary, if we do the rosary or memorari or whatever, can she still hear us if we just say it in our mind?
Okay. I think the word you're looking for is omniscient, to know all. Omnipotent would
okay.
be all powerful.
Okay. I'm sorry.
Yeah. No, it's okay. I just want to make sure we're talking about the same thing. So
yeah.
Let's take a step back. Okay. So no, first of all, Mary did not become omniscient. Only God is omniscient in a strictly infinite sense. Now, in heaven, we know that those in heaven have higher powers than we do in this life because, for example, Jesus said that in heaven there is great rejoicing among the saints and angels in heaven over even one sinner repenting. So if you consider how many billions of people are running around on planet Earth right now, and then let's say that some tiny fraction of that number of people is repenting at any given moment. Well, that's even if it's like 1% or less, it's still you're talking hundreds of millions of people at any given moment repenting. And Jesus says that in heaven, there's great rejoicing when even one person repents. So it's a strong, you know, indicator that their ability to know things in heaven far exceeds anything that we can do in this life. And that's to be expected because they're glorified. They're fully human. They're maxed out, so to speak, in their ability to be human and do the things that humans do. So that in itself is not a problem, but that doesn't require omniscience. It's a higher level, a higher order of magnitude when it comes to knowing things. So that's the first thing to keep in mind. Second thing is with regard to praying and can Our Lady hear you if you're not, you know, verbally speaking the words, the answer is yes, and here's why. The angels don't use speech. Think of it this way, Charlie, like the words that I'm saying to you right now, those are basically symbols. They're audible symbols. They stand for an idea. So let's say the word idea. We say in English, idea. Who knows how they say it in Chinese? I don't know. I don't know how they say it in Russian. But whatever the word symbol is that they would use in those languages, it refers to the same concept. Or, if, you know, I say, I say pizza. Now, maybe that's the same word elsewhere in the world, but let's say there's a different word for it. The reality of the thing itself, the pizza, we just use different symbols, whether we write them on paper or it's on a screen, or we use words. So these are intermediaries. They're not the actual thought itself. And here's why I'm going into this detail. It'll make sense in a second. We experience life with a very limited ability to communicate our thoughts, and we have to communicate them through these intermediary symbols, the little squiggles of ink on the page that mean something in different languages. All that is just a symbol. It's just telling you the meaning behind it. But the angels, they don't speak that way. They don't speak to each other. They don't have verbal conversations the way we are. They have something far, far better and far more intimate, which is they make their thoughts known to each other without the need for anything in the middle, like a word symbol. So they are in constant communication with each other. And they simply do this by opening their mind, so to speak, that's the word we would use, and let the other angel know what is being said and vice versa. So what happens functionally is that when you're praying and you're asking your guardian angel to help you, or you're praying and you're asking Our Lady to intercede for you, in essence, when you're not using your mouth at all, you're not speaking the words, they don't need you to speak the words out loud. It's not necessary that you utter the words out loud because, you know, they're not listening to you with ears the way we are here on earth, but you're opening your mind the way the angels do to each other, and you are communicating those thoughts with them that way. And that's a higher, better way than what we experience in this life. Now, I know that was a long answer, but it's, I think, helpful to understand the mechanics behind this to see why you don't need to say the prayers out loud.
Excellent. All right, Patrick, thank you very much. That answered my question.
I'm glad. Thank you for that. I appreciate the... Anytime I get a chance to talk about the angels, I'll take it. I think this would be a good opportunity to take a break, and then we'll come right back to your phone calls. Those of you who are holding, please stand by. I'm coming to you. 888-914-9149. I'll be right back.
You know, the word is spreading around America. This is the go-to place if you've got a prayer and you want the whole country praying for it. So I invite people to join us every night for the Family Rosary Across America Live.
7 p.m. Central.
Bringing Christ to the world through the media.
Relevant Radio.
Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forrester.
It's the Patrick Madrid Show. Join the conversation at 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. The Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
All right, we are back. Thanks for listening. I sure appreciate it. You can listen to everything in the program, all 3 hours of it, by going to relevantradio.com/Patrick. We post these shows about an hour after the show is over each day. And you can also access it quickly and easily on your Relevant Radio app. Wherever you are in the world, just use your Relevant Radio app and you can catch up on anything you might have missed. 888-914-9149. We'll go now to Victoria in San Francisco. Hi, Victoria.
Hi there. I was just wondering if you could give any advice to young Catholics today who are struggling on their campuses with the socialist, propaganda that they're giving us in school. And if you could give advice to any young Catholics who are trying to leave a virtuous life and start their families and how they can find other Catholics.
Ah, several important questions there. Let's start with you mentioned socialism, I believe, right? I know that's being pipelined into the minds of countless students in academia. I really like a book by Dinesh D'Souza. If you want to jot this title down, it's called United States of Socialism. And the subtitle is Who's Behind It, Why It's Evil, and How to Stop It. So I've seen a number of books about socialism that have come out in recent years. I'm happy to see them. I mean, the more the merrier, if you ask me. I particularly like this one because he gets into the roots of socialism historically, ideologically, and he traces the way in which it has made its way into our schools and into the mainstream media. And he answers a lot of the challenges that are raised in favor of socialism, including, for example, well, what about socialism in places like Sweden and Denmark, you know, that kind of socialism? And he shows how that it's not really socialism, things like that. So that would be a good book to recommend to you. Also, I'm a big fan of the work that they're doing at PragerU, P-R-A-G-E-R, then the letter U. They are so effective at kind of popping these balloons that many people they mistake as good arguments, and they're so effective at it that their videos have been deplatformed, or most of them anyway have been deplatformed from YouTube, because YouTube is ideologically way to the left, and these videos offer a counterpoint to a lot of the nonsense that's out there, and I think they feel threatened by it, so they won't allow them to publish most of their videos. And there's nothing wrong with them whatsoever. They're very thoughtful. They're very calm. They don't attack anybody. They just deal with the issues, and they have countless issues. So that might be another set of resources that you could look into just to give you information on discrete topics. Now, the second question you asked, I think, was about how to remain virtuous on campus. Was that the second question?
Yes, that was the second one.
Okay. Well, I mean, it's no great surprise that it's difficult to be virtuous in this world that we live in now. It's so easy to fall into sin, especially sexual sin. So a large part of it, seems to me, is to just exercise prudence in who you hang out with and, you know, how you hang out with people. So like I've told all of my sons and daughters, as they've gotten older and moved into young adulthood, I said, if you're going to be around somebody that you really like and are attracted to, don't be alone together. Don't be alone in a room together with the door closed, by all means, because we're all human beings and we're weak and we can fall very quickly under the right set of circumstances. So it seems like the most basic rule would be to just watch where you go and watch what you do. You can have fun and enjoy time with your friends and all of the above. I'm not suggesting otherwise. But don't put yourself in a situation where it becomes easy to fall into sin. That'd be kind of basic advice there. I would be careful.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. I would be really careful in what you consume. I'm sure that you're very conscious of your bodily health, so you don't want to eat anything that's going to hurt your body. Take the same approach to what you watch. You know, what do you look at? What videos are you watching? What media are you consuming? Because as the saying goes, you are what you eat. And people who have a diet of those things that are going to draw them into sin, eventually it's going to take hold. So be discriminating would be my advice. Be discriminating in what you let into your mind, you know, the way you would about what foods you might eat. And then also good company. The Bible says that bad company corrupts good morals, and the opposite is true. Good company enhances good morals. So that, I guess, leads to your third question. There are a lot of different groups that are together for the purpose of fellowship and finding a good husband, finding a good wife. I've known personally, in one particular instance, a young woman who wanted to be married, and she wanted to make sure she married a very good man. So she wound up meeting the guy that she married at a young adults organization in her diocese. And it was really good because they could go on all sorts of outings as a group, and they could see each other and other people. And eventually, you know, they kind of picked each other out of the crowd, and now they're happily married with children. So I would go where the good candidates are, go where the good young men are, find those groups, either on campus. The Focus Missionaries may be on campus there. You might get in touch with them, and they can plug you into groups that they're familiar with. Maybe the Archdiocese has some groups for young adults that you could participate in. All those kinds of things, I think, would be helpful. There you go, Victoria. What do you think?
Okay. Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate that. Yes, I'll look into all of that. Thank you.
You're welcome. If I can ask you, where are you in the trajectory of going through college? Are you just starting, or are you nearly finished?
I'm a sophomore. I'm going to be a sophomore.
Okay. So 3 years to go. Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, you know, here's something just a thought. Our good friends at Ignatius Press are in San Francisco, and I'm blanking on their address, but you know Ignatius Press, right? The premier, one of the premier Catholic publishers in the U.S. Are you familiar with them?
Oh, yes. Yes, I am.
Well, they are in San Francisco, and I think they're not far from Golden Gate Park, if I'm not mistaken. So maybe, just maybe, give them a call and just say, hey, I'm a young Catholic college student. I'm in the area. Can I come by? Maybe you could do a little volunteer work for them. And here's why. Because they know all the good groups, and they might be able to give you some really good customized advice for some groups or people that you could plug in with.
Okay. Well, thank you so much. I'll give them a call today.
Good. All right. Well, God bless you, Victoria. And I hope the next 3 years go very well for you. God bless you. 888-914-9149. Yeah, by the way, Jake, thank you for that. Yeah, their website is Ignatius.com. Ignatius.com. Tell them Patrick sent you. Let's go to Hannah now in Aberdeen, Maryland. Hi, Hannah.
Hi. My question is, can we gain indulgence for others?
You can. Yes, you can. So are you thinking about, say, the souls in purgatory?
Yes.
Yeah, you can certainly do that. Sometimes you'll run across a term in Catholic literature, usually it's older Catholic literature, which refers to suffrages. Suffrages do not refer to suffering. It has to do with you are choosing to apply whatever merit, whatever grace you might receive from penance or an indulgence, you're offering that for the sake of the souls in purgatory, or maybe even one particular soul in purgatory. So if you ever run across that term suffrages, your prayers and your suffrages, it's understood in that context that you can apply these things, or ask the Lord rather, to apply these things to the souls in purgatory.
All right. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you. How about Ernie now in Rosemead, California? Hello, Ernie.
Hi, I'm calling because I've just had several questions that I've always wondered about. One of them being, there in the Gospel of Matthew, it says that Jesus is when they're predicting the birth of Jesus that you shall call him Emmanuel, but they give him the name of Jesus, and I've always wondered why it's Emmanuel on there, and if it's a mistranslation or if it's just another name of the same name, why isn't it written as Jesus?
Yeah, sure. It's not a mistranslation. So that's in Matthew chapter 1, verse 23. Behold, a virgin shall conceive and bear a son, and his name shall be called Emmanuel, which means God with us. So that's the meaning of the term. But his given name was Jesus. So this is not a contradiction, but this would be similar to how his name is Jesus. His given name is Jesus or Yeshua, but he's called variously the Prince of Peace. He's called the Son of God. The Son of Man is what he called himself. So there are different titles that are applied to Jesus, even though his actual given name was Jesus. That's what you're seeing there. So not a contradiction, oh, okay. But it's reference to that title.
So it's a title more than a name, then? Am I understanding
right.
correctly?
Right, right.
Oh,
so
okay.
To use another example, so in Luke chapter 1, in the Magnificat prayer, Our Lady says, henceforth all generations shall call me blessed. Now, it doesn't mean that her name was no longer Mary, her name was Mary and remained Mary, but she's referring there to a title that would be applied to her. This is why we call her the Blessed Virgin Mary. That's to fulfill that biblical prophecy.
Got it. Oh, that's wonderful. Thank you so much. And
sure.
Another quick question I had is, I know that like that there's St. Michael the Archangel, and I've always wondered why. How could an angel be a saint? I thought it was like an earth, a human being that became a saint.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it's just bad theology on my part. I've always wondered that.
No, not bad theology at all. This is actually a fairly common question. You might be surprised. So keep in mind that the word saint is derived from holy. So saint in English, sanctus in Latin, and it comes closer from the Latin. Now, in the Greek, it's hagios. And so hagios in Greek, sanctus in Latin, or saint in English, it all refers to the same thing in terms of the holiness of the person or the righteousness of the person before God. And in the Catholic Church, we have become accustomed to using that term saint in a very particular way, referring to those in heaven, and even more particular, referring to those who have been canonized. But that's just a custom, and it doesn't restrict the use of the term saint to all those who are holy. So all the saints in heaven are holy, and angels, who are not human beings, of course, they're pure spirits, but they too, we regard them as holy because they have that holiness of God in them. They participate in that inner life of God. So we refer to the holy angels. We refer to Saint Michael the Archangel or Saint Gabriel the Archangel. It's not that they've been canonized. Rather, it's our recognizing
yes.
that they are holy before God.
Yeah, and are all angels by default saints as well?
Yes. Well, in the sense that we mean holy, the holy ones, yes, the holy angels, they are saints in that sense. They're not canonized, but we do regard them as saints in that sense. Now, the fallen angels, obviously the demons, are not holy. This is why we distinguish between the demons and the holy angels, or the good angels and the bad angels, so that we know that we're talking about those who love God and are with God.
Got it. I'm a long time, first time, so thank you for all you do, Patrick. This is amazing for me. Continue your good work. God bless you, Ernie.
Thank you. Pray for me. I'll pray for you. Thank you. How about Mary in Redding, California? It's good to have you on the air, Mary.
Yes. Thank you, Father. Patrick, mm-hmm. my question is about the Holy Crusade, and I believe that question that you had earlier from Nick was that he was a soldier. The Crusade was blessed by the bishop to go to war, to kill. Mm-hmm. And so how does that justify in the Catholic faith?
Well, they were indeed. They were blessed by the popes, typically, who would send the crusaders into battle. And that's not a bad thing, because not only were they being blessed in terms of asking God to protect them, but also asking God to give them victory. And there are times when war is necessary. War is terrible. We should do everything we can to avoid it. But sometimes it's unavoidable. And in the case of the Crusades, what had happened prior was that the Muslim expansion out of the Arabian Peninsula after the death of Muhammad involved the subjugation of these previously Christian lands. So imagine if, you know, Redding, California had been completely overrun and all of your churches had been turned into mosques and all the women were sold into sex slavery and all of the men of a certain age were killed. And most of the people were forced either to convert to Islam or to be killed. Some people would be allowed to live and they'd have to be third class citizens. They would pay a special tax called the jizya tax. So let's imagine if the rest of the world found out about what was going on in Redding, California, and you had, you know, Catholic men and other Christian men who said, we need to go and rescue them. We need to go and help them. Their homes have been taken. They've been sold into slavery. They've been killed and they're all of these other things. Well, that's a good thing for somebody to come to your rescue, to try to help you get out of that situation. And that's essentially what the Crusades were. The Crusades were not intended to force Muslims to become Catholic. That was never the case. The Crusades were never intended to steal land that rightfully belonged to the Muslims. This was conquered territory that was Christian previously, for the most part, and it was wrongfully taken from them. And there's much more to it, but as you can see, when you consider it from that standpoint...
You did answer it correctly. I mean, not correctly, but to my satisfaction. Thank you very much.
You're most welcome, Mary. Thank you. And we're out of time, so that's a perfect time to finish things up. 888. No. Why am I giving you the number? We're going to finish things up here. Let's leave it at that. Good timing. Excellent timing. Well, I look forward to being with you again tomorrow. And in the meantime, if you want to send me a message, you can do it on Twitter at Patrick Madrid, or you can send me an email at the show page. RelevantRadio.com/Patrick. Until tomorrow, I'll be praying for you. Please pray for me. God bless you.